One of the things that I know that you were involved with was the Nevin theft case. I just wondered whether you could tell that story.
Yes. Well, there was no... One of the things that triggered it off was that there was a dealer who was a perfectly straightforward dealer, came to see Charles Oman, the keeper of metalwork, bringing back a candlestick that he wasn't sure whether it was a genuine 16th or 17th century one, or whether it was a 19th century reproduction. And Charles Oman looked at it and noticed that there had been a number on the bottom of it, which he recognised as being a V&A number, because although the number had been cleaned off, it had just been put on with paint, it had left a mark, a sort of residue, that could be seen on the metal base. And there was various things that came together at the same time. I went along with Peter Flood to a bank vault where the Marquis of Ormond's silver was being stored. And the Marquis decided that he was fed up with paying the insurance on it. And he had the idea of lending it to circulation department, who would distribute it to appropriate museums with the right security, and that way he wouldn't have to pay insurance anymore. It would be covered by government indemnity. So all this silver came in boxes to the museum, and I was given the job of unpacking it. And they'd put it in boxes with lists of the silver, but stupidly, they hadn't put it in according to the list. I mean, there was no correspondence between the contents of the box and the list. And took a very long, I mean, I can't remember what time it arrived, but anyway, it was definitely time to pack up, and one hadn't finished it. So Nevin was given the job, although it was stored in the packers area, and Peter Flood decided for extra security that the boxes would be tied up and sealed so that nobody could tamper with them overnight. I mean, if the warders would patrol the packers the same as the whole of the museum at night. And the person given to do the job was Nevin, who was one of the museum assistants. And when it came to the last box, I found that the number of items were missing. They just weren't there. And we immediately phoned the bank, and they said, oh, it must have been our mistake, you know, because obviously you've taken all the necessary appointments. Well, then they realised that not only was it Nevin who'd taped up these boxes, but it was Nevin who had cleaned the numbers off all the objects that were going to a board of survey, and that was where objects that were either duplicate to collections or considered not worthy of keeping, being fakes or badly damaged, were either disposed of if they were sort of rubbish or too badly damaged to prepare, or quite often transferred to more appropriate collections. I remember on one board of survey quite a number of ethnographic objects were transferred to the Horniman Museum, in the same way quite an amount of, it was always sort of done, it was usually done by circulation department, but not with the staff of, there had to be people from other departments who were not involved, so objectively they could see what was going. And as I say, but always things were then put up for sale, and the money went direct into treasury funds, actually. I mean, the museum didn't benefit financially by doing it, so there wasn't any incentive to get rid of things just so we have more money to spend, because it went straight to the treasury. And it was sold anonymously, so because it was realised that. And then I got, I mean, I don't know what went on behind the scenes, but I got a call one morning from Peter Flood saying, will you meet me at this house in Chiswick? Which I duly did. And I mean, it was quite incredible. It was just a little house on a council estate. And even the curtains were fabrics from the museum collection. They were Duncan Grant fabrics that had been cut up. And they were eating off a Spode tea service, which had been stored in the basement. The big basement was called Clinch's Hole, where there was just purely storage of things that there wasn't room. For instance, I mean, you know, the ceramics department would have an enormous Spode service. Well, obviously, no way could they display the whole service. So the surplus, you know, went down there, and lots of surplus went down. So some of the things were stolen from there, but the real problem was that every year in the museum there was a quinquennial. That means every 5 years there was a quinquennial, where every object in the museum had to be found and located to make sure it was where it was supposed to be. I mean, record cards were kept everywhere. And so we didn't get round to doing it, because there were so much other things to do, getting the departments back to normal after the war, because, as I say, everything had been, you know, dispersed. Some of the most valuable objects to caves in the Mendips. Other things, of course, were out on loan from ceramics, from circulation department, both to art schools, museums and things, where they just got stuck and left there, or to embassies abroad, because we used to lend porcelain and various decorative objects to British embassies abroad. And so, generally speaking, you know, the apartments. So it wasn't till 1953 that they got round to doing the quinquennial. And then we discovered that a lot of objects were missing. They just weren't, you know, where they were. And nobody knew what had happened. And then, then turned out that he joined the museum in 1933 and had been gradually removing objects from the museum over that time. There's quite a number of things that had gone missing from the library or the print room or, you know, various places. And, you know, and when we realised that, I mean, it was just incredible. I mean, the house was just crammed with museum objects. The most awful thing was that so much of the things were damaged. He had a wonderful cabinet. I think it was a Renaissance cabinet, small one, out in his garage, using as a tool, you know, for tools and things. He'd prize statues off their basis.